The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is Evan Osnos, a writer for The New Yorker and the author of The Haves and Have-Yots, Dispatches on the Ultra-Rich. How timely. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us, remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Magic Spoon, Beam, and Harvest Hosts, in our show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It helps make this podcast happen. Hey, James, you might remember that Donald Trump promised he would end the Russian-Ukraine war on day one. It's now day 134, and this war is raging. But then Trump and J.D. Vance, in a setup with cameras in the Oval Office, thought it was a great idea to insult a Democratic ally, Ukraine President Zelensky. Trump tried to humiliate him by saying, in this war, you have no cards. Zelensky actually has something much bigger, drones, and a brilliant secret plan to use trucks with detachable roofs to get close enough to Russian air bases, and in a masterful strategic launch attack, 41 Russian strategic bombers, totally destroying a third. Some military experts said this was the greatest surprise attack since Pearl Harbor, and this time it was justified, and may mark a seminal moment in modern warfare. So I tell you what, J.D. and Donald Trump, keep your cards. Zelensky has something much bigger.
So I want to do a puzzle for our listeners, viewers, okay? Now listen very carefully to this puzzle and see if you can get the answer. I'll give you 0.1 second to think of the answer. So Steve Bannon criticized Lindsey Graham for going to Ukraine because no one, Zelensky, I don't know if they told Lindsey or not, didn't tell Trump about the plan. Why do you think that Zelensky didn't tell Trump about the plan? All right, your microsecond is up. Because he didn't want to tell Putin. And if you tell Trump, you're telling Putin. That's why, you dumb son of a bitch. You think they're going to tell Trump that they have an equivalent of Pearl Harbor? This is how fucking stupid people are. I mean, I don't know why people didn't jump on that. Maybe I missed it, the late night people. Jesus Christ, look at it. You didn't tell Trump there's this drone strike coming in. And right when Trump was saying, you have no cards, this guy was sitting there and said, you think I don't have any cards? Wait till you see me deal off the bottom of the deck and you'll start seeing aces flying everywhere.
Man, they got trucks. Drivers didn't know what they had, and they were detachable roofs. They got in there undetected, got close enough, and then those roofs came off, and the drones set off. It really was just absolutely brilliant. It took them a year and a half to do it. And for those who say that the Ukrainians can't survive any kind of protracted war, I think this at least changes those dynamics and certainly changes morale.
I think you agree with this. The Ukraine war is the great moral crusade of our lifetime. I'm sorry. That was a sovereign country. It was recognized. It's cut out. It went through every piece of rigmarole you had to be a country. It's right there. It's critical. And they just pulled off and started a fucking war.
Yeah.
Blowing people up in hospitals.
Breaking a trees, a right. peace pact.
This is a moral issue. Moral issue.
Well, isn't it surprising that Donald Trump is not rising to a moral issue? You know, I want to draw attention. Speaking of moral issues, let me draw attention to another topic. It was a superb Peter Baker story in the New York Times who pointed out Trump, who in his attacks against Harvard and other places, claims he is fighting anti-Semitism. Now, clearly there has been a problem at Harvard among other places, but Trump fighting anti-Semitism is a joke, as our guest Larry Summers noted last week. Trump dines with Holocaust deniers. He dispatched Vance to praise Germany's neo-Nazi party. Peter Baker adds some more details of Trump hypocrisy. He put out an image, Trump did last week, of him marching on a mission from God, fighting evil. The picture in the background is of an infamous anti-Semitic cartoon. Maybe he didn't know. That's kind of hard to imagine. Trump just appointed the head an office of special counsel, a guy named Paul Ingrassia, who has praised that same Holocaust denier and also criticized the arrest of a Nazi sympathizer who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. This man, the Nazi sympathizer who stormed the Capitol, has said, quote, Hitler should have finished the job, end quote. He also gave two speeches last year at Trump's New Jersey golf club. So thanks, Peter Baker, for further exposing what a total complete hoax Trump's crusade against anti-Semitism is.
Well, okay, so Trump's a complete fraud. Great. I tell you who this exposes in a more profound way. And I hear this all the time. I mean, you got to try to raise money from like really wealthy Jewish fundraisers. And it said, look, James, I'm Democrat, but I can't be a part of party because of what happened at Columbia. What the fuck did the Democrats have to do with what happened at Columbia, by the way?
Mm-hmm.
All right. But you, because they have some students at Columbia fucking, you know, generally made an ass of themselves. Well, I can't do that, but I can be for a party that everybody endorses the alternative for Deutschland, read the modern incarnation of National Socialism, if you will. And I just find these kind of people, my instinct is, and they tell me that, they look me right in the eye. And I said, no, you just want your fucking tax cut. Now that doesn't apply to most Jewish people see right through that. But the ones that don't see through it, they just don't really, at the end of the day, they just want their fucking tax cut. And you can see it every day.
Well, there's a guy named Bill Ackman who's the top of that list, James.
Put him right up there. Here I stand. I can do no other.
Right.
I just can't take what's happening at Harvard. Oh, really? And you would think that there were no Jews that ever went to Harvard. There are no Jews on the Harvard faculty.
The president of Harvard actually happens to be Jewish. And the president went twice removed. Our guest last week, Larry Summers, happens to be Jewish. And not only that, I mean, look, Harvard, you know, has its problems. And there was a problem with anti-Semitism, as a Harvard report acknowledged. And I'm sure that the faculty is overwhelmingly left-wing. But you know who else went to Harvard? I mean, Ted Cruz went to Harvard. What, four or five justices on the United States Supreme Court went to Harvard. Several cabinet members, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., went to Harvard. I think your good friend Steve Bannon even went to Harvard, James.
Well, while we're giving credit to him, what about the genius trade guy?
Peter Navarro,
PhD. So look, Harvard never occupied very much space in our market. I won't get into it anyway. The people that really get pissed at Harvard is people whose kids and nephew didn't get in. Those would be in Harvard. But I never thought that anybody could actually get me, of all the things in the world to feel sorry for, and all the injustices in the world, to actually get me to feel sorry for an institution with a $54 billion endowment. But these assholes did it. Congratulations.
Yep, they sure have. And, I kind of felt the same way. But boy, Harvard's showing guts. They're going to pay a price. It's going to hurt them. But they are standing up. And I think Larry last week was right. They've got to continue to stand up, despite some pressure.
Never thought I'd say this, but I'm pulling for the old crimson.
Absolutely.
Not the Crimson Tide.
Absolutely. Even, the Harvard Law Review, which is separate from Harvard, by the way, what the Trump White House did is they put a plan, or didn't put a plan in there. They had a plan in there, a guy named Daniel Wasserman, who fed them all kinds of information. And then guess what? He was hired to work for Stephen Miller after he supplied. And the information, it really was just kind of small bore stuff. But that's who they are, James.
Yeah, that's who they are.
Okay. James, just, where the suspense is building, the excitement just is rising, as only 9 days, I think, from now, there's going to be this great military parade celebrating the 250th anniversary of the United States Army and Donald Trump's 79th birthday. Are you excited?
I actually am. And I'll explain why. James Carville, I could get excited. All right, let me leave it at that. So in order for the almost perfect political event, there's certain elements you have to have. One, you have to have great visuals. Well, they're going to be great visuals. Ain't no doubt about that.
Right.
All right? No doubt about that. You have to have real coverage. I mean, it has to be kind of wall-to-wall. All the cameras are there. Everybody's there. The journalists, the podcasters, you got that. You're tying it to an event. You got that. And while they're doing this, they are horrifically slaughtering veterans in the big, beautiful bill. And if we're smart, there's some evidence that in some of these groups, they should not bring people to Washington. They should have people go in your own town square,
right,
with your own flags, and accentuate on Flag Day, by the way, it is Flag Day. Wave the fucking flag and talk about true patriotism is how we treat our veterans. And build crowds around that. And use that event to leverage it into the most damning attack. This is our Della Volpe. It's by far and away the most damning attack among the voters under 30 in a 1,000 sample. You know what that means if you take 1,000
sure
of 17% of the population.
Yep.
You also know instinctively that veterans, if anything, are going to be more popular with voters over 60 because more people were veterans in that demographic. You have the golden issue. The golden issue. And they all ought to be. And boy, do you have women's veterans now? Yeah. The military is compared as a percentage. Are you progressive? Get a load of this. There are more non-white people as a percentage in the United States Armed Forces than are in the general population. Why can't you stand up for justice for these people? This is elementary justice. All right?
James, and are you suggesting that Donald Trump doesn't love the vets, as he says?
Well, look, the man had some foot issues. Okay? What are they called? Corporal Bone Spurs there? He doesn't. He told you what he thinks of you. He said they're losers and suckers. Why do they do this? Understand, it's in the chances that General Kelly, who we know he told it to, we know that. Keep ramming it home. This is what's so frustrating to somebody like me. It's right in fucking front of you. The day is coming up. If you want to do something, get the flag, take the kids, take the grandparents, take the neighborhood, and go down to the courthouse square and talk about it. It's there. He cuts veterans because he thinks that they're all fools. Understand that. I mean, God,
well, okay, just June 14th. Let's hope for a split screen. There is Trump sitting there, and all of his cabinet will have to be there. Can you imagine a cabinet member saying, "I have a conflict"? He'd be an ex-cabinet member then, all there, you know, and worshiping.
And we go back to our camera in Grand Rapids,
Michigan. Exactly. Then I want to cut away to Omaha. Right. I want to cut away to San Antonio. I want to cut away.
Absolutely.
And have real people. Okay.
Absolutely. So I'm going to give our viewers a food tip here. And this is something I've discovered. If you like me, you like a little ice cream every now and then. Well, you know, I'm not particularly snobbish, but I like the truth of the matter, like vanilla and chocolate just fine. So when you go to the supermarket, get your high-quality ice cream, whichever flavor you like, and then scoop it in the bowl, and when you're watching the games or you're doing whatever you're doing, then take granola, the magic spoon granola, and cover that ice cream with it. First of all, you're not eating ice cream because you look for health food, although ice cream is probably less bad for you than a lot of other things. There's some good things you can say about it. But when you add that to it, it gives it a crunch, and you're not getting any fat. The taste profile is really good. I promise you. I've learned to do this, and it's just made my ice cream eating infinitely better. That's correct. Absolutely. It's got a lot of range. It's a kind of a 5-tool food. You know what I mean?
We're big fans of Magic Spoon's high protein, zero sugar cereal, and the treats that they reinvented from your childhood favorites. Not only will the taste fill you with nostalgia for your golden days of youth, but we also have exciting news. Now listen to this. Magic Spoon is launching a brand new high-protein granola. True to the Magic Spoon promise, it's packed with protein and the crunch is exquisite. Magic Spoon's high-protein treats are crispy, crunchy, airy, and an easy way to get 12 grams of protein on the go. Plus, they come in mouth-watering flavors like marshmallow, chocolate peanut butter, and dark chocolate. James loves them after a run, and he'll even double down with a bowl of cereal while he's working. Now, good news, James. You might be able to add in some more variety because Magic Spoon's brand new granola also packs in 13 grams of protein with zero added sugar. They come in delicious flavors like dark chocolate almond, honey almond, and peanut butter. You know I'm going for the peanut butter every time, but it's up to you. And right now, we have a deal for you. Get $5 off your next order at magicspoon.com/war room or look for Magic Spoon on Amazon or in your nearest grocery store. That's magicspoon.com/war room for $5 off. The link is in our show notes. Hey, James, there's no better journalist in Washington than Evan Osnos. He has written a fascinating new book, The Haves and the Have-Yots, about the super rich in America today. Take it over, James.
So, Evan, great to have you. This is the money question in my mind, and I know that you've thought about this a lot. The Gilded Age turned into the Progressive Era. The Roaring Twenties turned into the New Deal. This shit's going to end up somewhere, and it's not going to be where it is, okay?
Yeah. If
we just project, what is the result of all of this almost comical display of wealth that we're looking at? It didn't end well in 18th century France. It didn't win well in early 20th century Russia. How is it going to end in the United States?
It's such a great question. It is the question. And I'll tell you, the history on this is pretty eloquent. It wasn't an easy ending, as you say, for the first round of oligarchs in Russia after the Soviet Union. Often what happens is that when the leader, as he often does, ends up driving the economy into the soup. He starts looking around and realizing, hey, those are some pretty nice piles of money. And he brings in his own pals to take over from that first round of oligarchs. But here's the interesting and the relevant news for everybody out there, which is it actually depends on the public. The pattern is very clear that the key factor in reining in oligarchy of one kind or another is civil society. And that often, historically, has taken the form of street protests in many cases, or labor strikes, or investigative reporting, or some combination of all three. If you take the example of Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, it took 3 years of street protests, and in the end, he was out. In the United States case, this is so important, it was 17 years between the time that Mark Twain named the Gilded Age in 1873 and the passage of the first Antitrust Act in 1890. And so the lesson is it takes sustained attention, commitment, and focus. That's the takeaway. We're at the beginning of this process, not the end.
Well, Evan, your book certainly provides a lot of material for that sustained progress or effort. The haves and have yachts. The yacht story is so illustrative. Rich guy starts off, he buys a yacht. Then he gets a super yacht. And then someone says, hey, this rich guy over there has, what do they call him?
Mega yachts to giga yachts.
Giga yachts, which cost over $1 billion maybe. Mine is bigger than yours. I mean, it really is so ostentatious. And that's not the only thing. And you talk about these rich guys who get the recording artists to come in at an exorbitant price to play at a birthday party for their 13-year-old kid. And people like Steve Schwartzman and now Jeff Bezos are throwing. I mean, I have to think the public is turned off by that. Maybe I'm naive.
I think you're absolutely right, Al. Look, I think there's something very human about this instinct. It's just magnified on a very large scale. It's not that different from the guy who goes out in his driveway and looks at his own minivan and looks at his neighbor's minivan and thinks, you know, I might be ready to upgrade. I need a little more. But there is a point. Look, at the center of this is the question of, do Americans ultimately want to eat the rich or join them at the table? And we know, you and I both know, Al, it's a combination of both. I mean, that is the core American idea, is that we really do believe in the power of being able to aspire to have that. That's what we are. That's it's baked in. Always have, always will be. But the thing is that we are also deeply bothered in our bones when it begins to seem as if somebody else's advantages are so profound and out of step with history that they're actually standing in the way of my ability, your ability, anybody's chance of getting that piece of the American dream. I think there is a real ambivalence at the core of it. The most illustrative piece of data I've come upon in the last, you know, several years on is this key fact. 59% of Americans will tell you that billionaires are making the country less fair, and the identical share of Americans will tell you they want to be a billionaire themselves. And very often, it's the same respondents giving the answer. That is just who we are. And I think it's a very fragile and delicate balance. And these kinds of, this is the key word, brazen demonstrations of a really historic, almost unprecedented degree of imbalance is testing and perhaps breaking that balance.
Well, I think these billionaires are doing damage, but I want my kid to become a billionaire so he can support me.
Exactly.
In my old age.
Exactly.
And, you know,
that's the American dream.
This wonderful book, The Dispatches on the Ultra Rich, you spent considerable time with high-tech people in the Silicon Valley and also back in your hometown of Greenwich, Connecticut, and Wall Street types. They both are greedy. They both like money. They both have turned too much to Trump. But is the culture different?
Yeah, I think the culture is the key question. I find that the most interesting piece of it. Because, look, we see that there are many different ways to be a billionaire or a centibillionaire. Look at Warren Buffett. You know, he's on our minds these days because he's now passing the torch.
Right.
He has been very eloquent over the years about saying pretty clearly, it makes no sense for this country that I love to give me an effective tax rate that is lower than my secretary's tax rate. Good luck defending that, defending the logic of that. And he has also said, look, I have benefited immensely from this country. I've prospered, and I'm going to give as much of it back as I possibly can. And he and Bill Gates, of course, as you know, have really committed themselves to that. And I think part of this project, part of the point of this book, is to draw attention to the fact that that is a way that you can be both contributing massively to the innovation and success of this country while also making sure that other people are going to get a leg up when the moment comes. And we are seeing, to be blunt about it, there is a generation of guys that come after Buffett and Gates who really don't subscribe to that view. I mean, you've heard Elon Musk. He says the greatest gift he can make to humankind is being the CEO of Tesla. And that's a very different kind of thing. Leave it to Bill Gates. He put it best, as he said recently after the destruction of USAID. He said, the picture of the world's richest man killing the world's poorest children is not a pretty one. Bill Gates said it well, I think.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And, you know, so much of these new super rich types have embraced Trump. They identify with his greed. However, Evan, in our capitalist system, it depends on a modicum of a rule of law, which Trump and his enablers have a disdain for. These are smart guys. I mean, I may not like their values, but they're smart guys, a few women, but mainly guys. Do they have any appreciation of what it means to have a disdain for the rule of law for them in the long run?
It's a real interesting question. Do they anticipate where this goes? Do they see the patterns of history? I think, having spent a lot of time with these folks over the last decade or so, talking to them about their decision-making, in many cases, they have these very kind of calculated positions about Trump. And you could see it right there on that stage. I mean, it is, without giving away any confidences, you know, there were some billionaires on that stage who, you know, some of them were ideologically very close to Trump. Others were there on that inauguration stage because they're afraid of what he could do to them. Some of them got off and almost immediately started telling others that they were embarrassed to be there. I think that they have a belief that they are ultimately, they're surfing the tides of what's happening. And historically, they've profited and benefited and thrived in a system that has a rule of law. And I think they now are at the point where they're gambling, frankly. I think they're gambling with the idea that they can ultimately ride out the storm and end up on the right side of it. Look, this is the problem of a country in which you have a personalistic application of the law, not a rule of law.
Yes.
Is that it forces, it makes the elite figures, the ones who feel exposed, it makes them bargain. It makes them say, I got to end up on the leader's good side, or I'm going to end up on the bottom. That's no way to run a republic, frankly.
Let me talk about one of them. You spent time with Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook, I guess it's called Meta now. I've been around him, I think, only once, never really had a conversation. So from that unenlightened position, I think he's a genius, a personal asshole, and devoid of any moral compass. Is that unfair?
That was about an elegant description. Would have saved me a few thousand words if I'd just come to that myself. I think he is a person who was utterly unprepared for the effects of his own genius. Let's call it that. He came up with a big idea as a teenager. He turned it into the biggest company that literally the history of enterprise has ever really known in terms of its impact. It has more users than Christianity, to put that in clear terms. And yet he was not remotely prepared, as I concluded from our conversations, remotely prepared for the questions of what does it mean? What is the meaning of truth? How do you defend it? How do you define it? What is the meaning of hateful speech? What are the origins of violence? I think he basically believed in one big idea, which was growth for growth's sake. The euphemism is connecting people. You begin to notice that in his language. He says we stand for connecting people. That means scale at all costs. And the problem with scale at all costs is that the costs can be immensely high.
Well, he did talk to you about his legacy, and you know, he'd got a long way to go to follow in the footsteps of the Rockefellers, Vanderbilts, or Carnegies, or the ones you mentioned, Gates, Buffett. I would add Michael Bloomberg to that mm-hmm. list. He's going to have to change a hell of a lot, which seems unlikely if he wants to have the kind of legacy that those super rich have and had.
Yeah, I happen to know for a fact that he started out his philanthropy imagining himself as a kind of heir to Bill Gates, in the sense that, you know, you'll notice that Gates was a kind of a mentor of his in the early years, and you know, you'll notice that he started this Zuckerberg started a philanthropy with his wife. It was very similar. It was going to be devoted to issues like public health and education, and over time he has just chosen a path that is farther and farther away from what that Gates image was. I think what happened, Al, having really sort of lingered on this for a long time, is that I think Zuckerberg was really scorched, and this applies to many of the people in this book. He was scorched by the experience of discovering that the public didn't see him the way that he saw himself. And this is true of Musk and of many others in there, that they become so surrounded by people who they have, you know, essentially handpicked, who tell them all the time, you're a man of great things, you're making an imprint on history, that they just are often, they're really traumatized by the discovery that the public doesn't really see them that way, and that the public holds them to account. And as a result, they can get quite bruised and end up, as we see in this, particularly in this second term, we see that there are a number of these tech tycoons who have decided, you know, Trump is giving me permission put myself in his image more than in the image of, right, of those who came before.
It's also one of the reasons, I think you're right, that they like these yachts. They can isolate. They can get away. They don't have to be around people. They don't have to face criticism. It's a wonderful escape.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I write about politics and foreign affairs, and I sometimes ask myself, how did I end up writing a book that has yachts in the title? And that's for a very clear reason, which is these things are the clearest monuments of the values that dominate the landscape of our time. And I think these super yachts are kind of super symbols in a strange way. It's, you know, they're literally pleasure boats the size of a football field that cost the better part of $1 billion. They're the most expensive objects that our species has ever figured out how to own, Al. I mean, they're more expensive than the most expensive piece of art, the Salvator Mundi by Da Vinci, which I'll add, not incidentally, is now believed to be hanging on a giga yacht owned by MBS of Saudi Arabia, though we wouldn't know because it's not in a museum. It's very hard to check. That right there is an emblem of our time.
Boy, it sure is. You mentioned you cover politics and foreign affairs, so I'm going to draw on your expertise. There's no better China watcher than Evan Osnos, based on your years over there. Right now, the Trump versus Xi Jinping confrontation, how do you see it playing out? Who holds the upper hand?
I think that Xi Jinping has a much greater tolerance for pain and confrontation than Trump does. I don't need to be harping on the taco trade to point out that Trump has a pretty reliable pattern of performance in his negotiating strategy with other countries. Xi Jinping has quite a different pattern. He holds his cards very close. He does not make extravagant claims and threats and promises. He basically waits until the last moment when he needs to state his position. And the most important piece of this, frankly, is that he gains domestic power by standing up to the United States. It doesn't hurt him. What he gains out of it is that it enacts what he has always said would be the case, which is that there would be eventually a confrontation between these two. You know, I if there's one detail that drives this home for me, Al, it's that state TV in China over the last few years has started to rebroadcast these documentaries about the dark old days of the Cold War, when the Chinese people had to gird themselves against confrontation with the West. And one of the ways they did it, of course, was by learning to eat off the land, to eat tree bark, as one very memorable essay put it, that was circulating on the Chinese internet. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm not sure how many of my friends and neighbors here are ready to eat the tree bark. So I think that the Chinese are you know, they're digging in. And the question is, does Trump have enough strategy and staying power to win on that one?
It's also in the story that you know so well, when Henry Kissinger asked Zhou Enlai what he thought of the French Revolution. He said it's too soon. they tend to have more patience and historical patience than we do.
And, you know, look, part of it, you know, Al, the reason part of it is, look, it's a brutal authoritarian regime. They don't have to change government every 2 years, every 4 years. So, it's easier to have a long view. But we don't get to pick our counterparts. We got to deal with exactly who's over there. And the guy who's over there is going to be president as long as his body holds out. Whereas our president is on a bit more fragile terrain.
Put it mildly. Evan, is there anyone in the Trump 2.0 administration that engenders confidence?
That's a great question. And I don't mean to make an ostentatious pause here. I'm genuinely trying to think through who I think is done the reading. I'll tell you one person. There's an undersecretary of defense named Elbridge Colby, who is somebody who has thought hard about
Bill Colby's
the future.
Son?
Grandson. Exactly right.
Right.
And what's interesting is, look, I don't agree with Bridge Colby on everything, but I respect his commitment to trying to understand the issues and to being devoted. He's somebody who specializes essentially in this question of what is the future of Asia and the United States. He's very concerned about war with China. You know, I don't agree with him that the U.S. is overextended in Ukraine, but I think that he is somebody who is at least making a good faith, well-supported bid at it. And he may well end up being the Secretary of Defense if Mr. Hegseth does not prove to be quite as durable as he might hope.
Well, don't ask me, because I said back in April, there was no way that Hegseth could last through the month of May. So I'm, I'm still hoping. Listen, this has been wonderful. The book is The Haves and Have Yachts by, I think, Evan Osnos. There's no better reporter in Washington, with a possible exception, no better journalist, and a possible exception of his wife, Sarah Beth Berman, who heads the American Journalism Project. So if we're putting a plug in for the book, let me put a plug in for the American Journalism Project that's trying to save local journalism. It's a great cause. Evan, thank you so much for being with us.
My great pleasure, Al. It's a treat to join you. Thanks for having me.
You know, when you get a good night's sleep, and we're very big on this show, you want to bring, because it's so critical to how you feel the next day, you want to bring all of the tools that you can have to help you do that. Bean is key in your toolbox, and it's not like narcotic, or you're not taking something, you know, you're going to cause you to hallucinate or anything, but it is going to cause you to relax. And help you get a better night's sleep. And that's worth everything in the world to people.
Every day there are new outrages designed to overwhelm us and take us out. So don't give in. Wake up every day ready, refreshed, and energized to take on the day. That's why we've turned to Beam's Dream Powder, a natural sleep blend designed to help you get the deep, restorative rest your body and mind need to stay in the fight. I love the chocolate peanut butter, as our listeners know, but let's get into it. What is it that makes dreams so effective? Simple. Thanks to science-backed ingredients like reishi magnesium, L-theanine, apiagenin, and melatonin, Dream helps you fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up ready to organize, resist, and raise hell, all without the fog or the crash. Since we started using Dream, our focus has come back and our energy has returned. Now that we're ready to face the day and ready to stand up for the things that matter, it's better to become a must in our nightly routine to help us recharge, get up, stay engaged in what matters most. Beam's Dream Powder has improved over 17.5 million nights of sleep for people across the country. And you can be one of them. So here's the deal. Right now, Beam is offering up to 40% off their best-selling Dream Powder for our listeners. Now, it's a limited-time offer and the perfect way to overcome that exhaustion and stay in the fight every day. Go to shopbeam.com and use the code WARROOM at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/WARROOM and use code WARROOM for up to 40% off. Sleep well, wake up ready. The fight continues, and the link is in our show notes. You know, James, there's a very fraudulent debate going on over the House-passed Medicaid cuts. House Republicans, Trump, now maybe Josh Hawley, and some pundits and reporters contend that slashing this program by almost $750 billion, it's not going to cut anyone's benefits. It's all about waste, fraud, and abuse or work requirements. Let me just offer a few facts. The Medicaid cuts in the House are $723 billion. A study a few years ago by HHS found waste, fraud, and abuse in that program was negligible. As for the work requirement for Medicaid recipients, it was tried in several states, Arkansas and Georgia, and was a failure. It was about complex paperwork that caused legitimate beneficiaries to lose their benefits. Of non-disabled Medicaid beneficiaries under 65, the vast majority, 92% are either working, caring for a family member, managing an illness or disability, or attending school, according to KFF, the gold standard for healthcare data. A few other points. Medicaid is a federal-state program. Each state has a Medicaid fraud unit. And despite Trump's claims, undocumented workers are not eligible for federal Medicaid benefits. James, CBO, Reliable Congressional Budget Office, projects almost 8 million beneficiaries are going to lose their benefits because if this bill were enacted into law, and with other measures, eventually 10 million. If these Republicans were honest, they'd say, hey, we think tax cuts are more important than the money we're spending on Medicaid. They won't do that, and what they're saying is dishonest.
Well, for my outrage, I have to have proof because you're not going to believe what I'm getting ready to say. So I'm going to rely on a news organization called Reuters. I think you can vouch for them. They've been around for a long time.
Yep.
Okay. I'm going to read you this because I'm not going to editorialize right now. Staff of the Federal Emergency Management Agency were left baffled on Monday after the head of the U.S. Disaster Agency said he had not been aware the country has a hurricane season, according to four sources familiar with the situation. The remark was made during a briefing by David Richardson, who has led FEMA since early May. It's not clear to say whether he meant it literally as a joke or some other context. Wait a minute. So you don't know, is hurricane season a joke? Do you have any fucking idea? No, they don't. And let me tell you, they have all of these cuts, and all of these cuts to the Weather Service. They're not going to be able to send these planes in there like they used to. Worse than that, and this guy doesn't understand that. You know what comes, what crops up around hurricanes? Tornadoes. And you got to have sophisticated weather forecasting to give people a warning. We have a FEMA director that has never fucking heard of hurricane season. Right? And by the way, hurricanes, I think Trump is trying to hurt his own people. Hurricanes, the states that are more likely to get hurricanes are North Carolina, South Carolina, somewhat Georgia, Florida, huge, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, all up a fucking red. All right. All his stamps, his stuff that he's cutting, like SNAP programs or Medicaid, it's adversely affecting his people. He hates the people that vote for him. So he puts a FEMA director in that's never heard of hurricane season when the hurricanes are hitting red areas much harder than they hit blue areas. It just a year ago, they were complaining in North Carolina about they needed more FEMA in Western Carolina. This is all so goddamn crazy. You don't know how to deal with it. You really,
James, this guy's going to make George W. Bush's famous Brownie look like a Rhodes Scholar. I mean, this is
Brownie.
They've hit a new bottom.
he did show horses or something. Actually, this guy, I'll say one thing, Browning knew when hurricane season was. Yeah. And this level of incompetence and buffoonery and outright hurting his own. You got to understand this about Donald Trump. More than anything, he hates his own voters. And he proves it every day. You know how they measure hurricane depth? A lot of people do, called the Waffle House Index. And if you took the areas surrounding Waffle Houses all the United States, I know because I eat that all the time. Probably every Democrat ever ate that. That's the people that get hurt. If you think of who's going to the Waffle House, that's the people that get hurt. And I'm telling you, the people that go to the Waffle House are overwhelmingly Trump people.
Yeah.
He's trying to hurt them. So I see a lot of these RV, you know, they have a great culture. That most of them are retired, and they have these. This company is unbelievable, and they have like a social structure. Where you get your water and empty your sewage and fuel or whatever you need, and you have a lot of other people. Well, that's a lot of upfront money to go out and buy an RV and to map everything out where you're going. Where you get this, it's turnkey travel at it, the best you can imagine. You get in, they tell you where you can stay. You got a map, you got a place to go, you got an RV. And then when you want to go back, you give it back to them. You don't have to sit there and figure what I'm going to do with this, how I'm going to save the tires over the winter, or whatever else you got to do. I wish I'd have thought of this.
Yeah.
This is a superb idea.
Yeah, it sure is, because hotels are expensive. And camping, you know, doesn't have to be.
People that do that don't want to stay in a hotel. They want to stay in their own camp.
No, yeah. I agree. You know, so when it comes to a road trip, you know, we need a high comfort, low cost alternative that means that whether you're getting long in days or have vacation days to use, stop visiting the same old places. It's time for all of us to try something new and escape on fresh and unique adventures. That sounds like a blast, but even if we've dreamed of a curated RV trip, the planning can feel overwhelming. Luckily, there is a way to make it fun and exciting and, most importantly, easy. That's why this podcast is sponsored by Harvest Hosts. Ask yourself, do you own or rent an RV? Which is better? With a Harvest Host membership, you get unlimited, no-fee, overnight RV stays at 9,500 locations across the United States and Canada. Simply sign up for $79 a year, book your favorite destinations, and enjoy unique RV stays all year long. Forget parking your RV at a boring rest area. Harvest Host lets you stop overnight at amazing locations like wineries, orchards, museums, farms, golf courses, drive-in movie theaters. I didn't know they still had drive-in movie theaters. That's great. I'm going to try one of those. And more. Add adventure to your travel, all while discovering new destinations and supporting unique business across the country. James and I like to say we've seen it all. The truth is we still have a lot to cover. Fortunately, Harvest Hosts can give you some of your own. If you're like us and love seeking out landmarks, history, and exciting places you can find across the country, Harvest Hosts is for you. Pick your destinations and book the best host locations on your route with their mapping tool. Most hosts confirm with you in 5 minutes. Add in over 50,000 five-star reviews. You're sure to love your journey. Membership starts at $79 a year, so you can finally sign up for a service that doesn't break the bank. Head to harvesthost.com and use the code WARROOM for 20% off. Harvest Host Membership. Once again, that's harvesthosts, plural, .com for 20% off, and make sure you use our promo code WARROOM so they know we sent you. The link is in our show notes.
Yeah, by the way, there's a great drive-in theater right south of Winchester, Virginia.
Is there?
I highly recommend it. And if you have your Harvest Host, you do that, and you go ahead, do that, and you're close to Gettysburg, you're close to Cedar Creek, you're close to every historical site you can imagine, and you're close to the...
That's great, because you don't see them very...
No, you don't see them a lot. But
I know.
They only Winchester.
I know.
One thing about the Shenandoah Valley, they ain't all that high on progress. Hit the road with Harvest Host.
All right, now for our listener questions. And James, I'm going to tell you, they really get better all the way. These people are turned on. They're energized and they ask good questions. And it's really hard to eliminate some. But we'll make, if we didn't ask your question this week, please come back. We'll try it next week. Tim in Omaha, Nebraska, asked you, he's talking about Steve Bannon, said that Elon Musk has backdoor access to all the government's data. And that might be true. Shouldn't this be a source of great concern?
Presumably. I mean, Elon Musk was going to come in and he was going to find, he's going to have big balls and, you know, hundreds of people that were undeterred and unencumbered by the huge federal bureaucracy, and they were going to find $1 trillion and save it. They ain't found shit. Okay? And so I can't imagine anything good is going to come out with Elon Musk keeping a lot of data on people. But this whole thing is one of the great. And now, almost hilariously, Musk is now attacking Trump left and right. You know, he used to say something that when I think it was Major League Baseball was thinking about hiring Colin Powell or something. You said you should never hire somebody you can't fire.
That was Wyche Fowler who told the commissioner. Yeah. When the commissioner said to him, we could hire someone like Colin Powell. Why should we hire a little pissant like you? Wyche said, because you don't want to hire someone you can't fire.
Right. And they gave Elon Musk a job, and the firing didn't work well. And it's not going to work well.
No.
And he's going to keep doing it. And he hates these fucking people. Now, you fired a guy worth $300 billion. Is it $300 billion? I guess it is. Dollars. It's not a good idea. Let me tell you, it's Scott Bassett, or whatever his name is, or Howard Luck, Stephen Mill. It's not going to end well, boys. This guy, he's not a live and let live guy. Trust me, he's going to spend his money trying to fuck you in any way that he can.
Right. Right, right. Be careful.
Be careful.
Steve in Honolulu, Hawaii asks, Trump's favorability numbers are not good at the 100-day mark. Do you think Trump even cares about his polling numbers as he can't run for re-election again? Steve, he cares about them because he'll lie about them if they're bad. He'll find some phony poll and say, I'm really popular. Don't believe all the other polls. They just hate me. What he really cares about are several things. He cares about revenge. He's going after everybody who he thinks did him wrong. Of course, he was the one that did the wrong. And he cares about greed. He cares about grifting. He cares about making a lot of money. Those are that's primarily what he's interested in for the next 3 years. And if a poll number comes in that's bad, you know, Trump will just say it's a phony poll. It's fake news.
First of all, he cares much more about stealing than his poll numbers, because, you know, he's not going to run re-election again. Be lucky, I mean, given where he is, he might have, his cognition is slipping so fast, but that's not it. The Trump's bad poll numbers. This is all that I hear. But what about the Democrats? They got a 27 approval rate. Okay, legit point. We lost an election. Democrats don't like losing elections. Okay, we got a low approval rating. How about we winning every election? And we're going to win this summer. I have ultimate confidence that the congressional leadership is rallying the troops. They know exactly what's coming. They're not going to be able to make them pay maximum price for voting all this. And then when you keep driving, don't worry about your numbers, just drive their numbers down. And when you start presenting alternatives, when they give us a chance to talk about veterans, okay, that's a big one. I keep repeating it. They're going to give you that opportunity when it's talking about helping people who are trying to make it, people who are struggling, who are working and holding two jobs at the same time that need help for supplemental nutrition or anything else. Do that. Drive, ram it home, ram it home, ram it home.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Nate in Leavenworth, Kansas.
Oh, okay.
I assume he's on the outside in Leavenworth, Kansas.
I'm from Leavenworth.
Are Trump and cronies using on-again, off-again tariffs as a kind of pump-and-dump scheme, crashing the market with the tariff threats, buying low, then lifting them to profit off the rebound, James? Can you imagine Donald Trump doing that?
Let's see. I'm in New York City. Did the sun come up over the Atlantic Ocean this morning? Well, I guess it did, didn't it? Of course. You know, there's this great piece about the taco trade. He doesn't have any fucking idea. Okay. He wakes up and he says, this is good. They did the U.S. Steel Nippon agreement. A lot of people thought this was a good idea. A lot of people thought it was a bad idea. But then he announces, because it just sounds good, it's going to be a 50% tariff on foreign steel. He doesn't even know. He has no idea. Whatever impulse comes to his mind, he just does it that day. And don't ever think there's a strategy behind this, because there is none.
Yeah. No, he gets, well, there is a strategy. Make money.
Yeah.
That's the strategy.
The strategy behind everything.
There is someone named Hick in Charleston, Hick. South Carolina.
Hey, Hick, how you doing?
Hick, good to have you join us. You've helped our demographics, we hope, although Charleston is awful highbrow. Great city, though.
He says,
who can I trust for getting my news? Hick, that is a really complicated question, because you don't want to get your news from any one or two or three sources if you can. If I had to pick one, it would be the New York Times. I think the New York Times does great work, particularly during this administration. But also, I think the Washington Post, despite its internal problems, still is doing good work. The Wall Street Journal is doing good work. And then there are other sites. I mean, we talk about Jim Fallows and Breaking the News and how important that is. And there are Ryan Lizza has a new blog, which I think is really, really interesting. And you can watch that. And I do watch some cable news, not much. I don't like a lot of it. I think Jen Psaki's doing a good job on MSNBC. And I'll tell you what I do, Hick. And, you know, if you're watching our show, you may be sympathetic to our point of view. I try at least once a week to spend an hour or two watching Fox. And I can't say that I'm educated a lot, except I will see that what topics they're talking about, namely Joe Biden, most of the time. So don't limit yourself to one or two. And I hope the Charleston Courier is doing a good job for your local news. That's a long-winded answer, but it's the best I can do, James.
I'll give you a more short-winded answer. First, listen to Politics War Room every Thursday morning.
James, can I jump in? I forgot the most important. Please watch the PBS News Hour. Right. Otherwise, I'm in deep trouble with my wife.
Right. PBS News Hour is great. I'll tell you, now I think the Times is doing a really good job, but boy, they got a lot to atone for, but that's okay. We all got a lot to atone for. The Post is now hiring AI to do the stories. I saw it, but whether it's true or not, but you can look it up. I know I saw the story. Honestly, I agree with you. Fox should be part of your diet, at least some of these right-wing blogs. Do you know what's not bad is drugs? I mean, they have
true
stories, you can see some, but they don't create content. You can just link to everything else. Then at the bottom, there are probably 50 sites that you can list. Some of them are really good. Politico's a honest publication. I know you can link to anything on there. Man, if I had one place to go and one site to go to, I think I would go to Drudge, because you can get so many things off of there. The other one I really like is a site called Mediaite. The graphics on it are very clean. It's the same thing. They produce some original material, but not much. But most of them, they link. I mean, that's the editors as Dan Abrams' idea what a significant story is, but I don't think they have an ideological bias, and the stories they link to are pretty interesting. And just of necessity, if you're just the facts, you're going to have a lot more stories that are not going to be very favorable to Trump, because if you just go like Paul Krugman famously said, you know, it's just a fact that facts have an inherent liberal bias to them, and they do.
Well, another good aggregator is Real Clear Politics. I usually look at that.
And they're definitely not a left-wing crowd.
Right.
Real quick, no, they're not. But they do.
They tilt right, but you can get a good, right. good survey of interesting
stories.
Yeah,
and these aggregators, it doesn't, their tilt doesn't matter that much. What they're looking for is interesting stories, obviously, that get clicks. And you got to be aware of that. So, I mean, you should. The other one I really like is the Saturday Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, yeah. And the Saturday FT.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good weekend. John in Gurnee, Illinois, who I think is a really good, loyal questioner, says, why do Democrats think they can win elections in Texas, especially for senators? Are they relying on the Latino vote to pull them through?
Well, let me confess that I think Texas should be part of the future. And the reason that we get a little overexcited with it is there are a lot of people moving to Texas, there are a lot of people with college education moving to Texas. They're getting ready to nominate the United States Senate, maybe one of the worst people in American politics. And there's just sense that we just can't quite get there. I mean, it was Beto got very close. Colin Howard did not do as well as we would have liked for him to done. We got a big idea, a big thing coming up. I think we ought to, it's very expensive. But I do think Texas is worth the investment. And I do think that if we're smart and we get away, which we're trying to do, this jackass identity politics, I can't tell you how much that hurt. It stopped all momentum and it put us in reverse. I think the more we get that behind us, the better off we're going to be.
Yeah, I agree. And if the Republicans, as you suggest, I think they are, if they end up nominating the Attorney General, Ken Paxton, who is a certified crook, according to his former aides, that's not some Democratic effort to paint him that way. I think Texas could be winnable in a good Democratic year with a good candidate.
And, you know, you got to have hope and you got to try to push it. If you can get, you can get it blue. But in, of course, we just chase off so many, you know, quote Latinx, unquote voters. We're lucky if we carry the Rio Grande Valley anymore. Thank you, NPR. The great job you did there.
James Pat in San Francisco, California, asked, term limits. Hard answer, yes or no? Seems like a yes is a no-brainer. Pat, I'm going to disappoint you. I'm against term limits. I'm also against people staying in office too long, as Joe Biden sadly reminded us. But I think there are people, you know, like Nancy Pelosi or Bob Dole, who served, 20, 30, 40 years, Ted Kennedy, and they did it with remarkable, and are doing it, in Pelosi's case, with remarkably effectiveness. I think Biden, I think that Dianne Feinstein should have left well before. I don't think Chuck Grassley is with it to really be a senator today. So I would leave it up to the voters rather than some kind of legislated term limits.
I concur 100% with you. And, you know, sometimes the voters are going to do something, but, in a defense, everybody knew Chuck Grassley was 90 years old.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make this statement right now. The most important thing in the coming of the elections is candidate quality.
Right.
Be sure that we give an alternative to them, that we have really good recruiting, that you out there, when your people want to know what they can do, when you see somebody's thinking about running that looks like they'd be a really good candidate, then send them an email saying, I'm going to send you a check. I'm 100% for you doing this.
And you bringing up Grassley, there's no place, well, their places is important, but this is really critical in Iowa. Because
there.
I think Iowa, which has turned very red in the last several elections, I think they could, the Democrats could capture the governorship, and I think Joni Ernst, the incumbent senator who facetiously talked about people dying last week, I think she could be vulnerable against a good candidate, and they haven't produced good candidates for the most part.
I agree, but there's some people that are coming up, and they, you know, they look good on paper. I'm going to try to look at, try some clips of them. I agree with you. Iowa is a go. And by the way, don't forget the tariffs. But above all, I recommend, without their hesitation, equivocation, or anything else, ram this veterans issue home. Huge in Iowa. Huge.
Yep. Final question. It's a good one. Kristen in Jacksonville, Florida. Do you guys feel Biden's cover-up of his diminished capacity is equal to the GOP's blindness to Trump's dictatorship?
Well, I would answer the question if I ask myself. It doesn't matter. I mean, no, because Biden's obviously cognitive slippage and the inability and willingness to deal with that over a period of time, I think it's a general story. I don't have any problem with people covering it. I don't have any problem with the Jake Tapper book. I think it, my own view, and I said it before, it was a kind of a water is wet book because 80% of the public thought that Biden was too old. Much bigger is the destruction of democratic institutions because that's going to outlive everything we have. That's the profound impact of that going forward is going to be staggering. The impact of President Biden staying in the race too long is, if anything, it'll draw more attention to the issue, and something like this is not going to happen again. I think it's legitimate to question people in the White House as to why they didn't say something. I think it's legitimate to ask the press why they didn't make a bigger deal out of this. People knew this was coming. But this is a temporary screw-up, something that shouldn't have happened. The march to authoritarianism has much more permanent texture to it. And I think both are not good, but I think one is a lot more profound and longer.
Well, James, I agree with you with one small caveat. The Biden mistake led to Trump.
Right.
And
it did.
And that's his legacy.
It was and the mistake of not having given Democrats a choice and telling the country, this is what you have to vote for. No, I'm unsparing in my criticism that this whole disaster we have is a lot of it you can blame the Democrats for. Good point.
All right, listen, we love these questions. I know there were some we didn't get to, which I really, really feel badly about, and we'll try to get to them next week because they are so good. We didn't get to Barbara in Aiken, South Carolina. I'll just repeat her question because you can guess the answer. The Trump Library, an oxymoron? Yes, you're absolutely right, Barbara. Thank you. So we'll get to the others next week. Thanks a lot. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Magic Spoon, Beam, and Harvest Host, and our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.